The third trip, or Beanar. The purple sage cursed and waxed sorely pissed and cried out in a loud voice, "A pox upon the accursed Illuminati of Bavaria. May their seed take no root. May their hands tremble, their eyes dim, and their spines curl up, yea, verily, like unto the backs of snails. And may the vaginal orifices of their women be clogged with Brillo pads. For they have sinned against God and nature. They have made of life a prison. And they have stolen the green from the grass and the blue from the sky." And so saying and grimacing and groaning, the purple sage left the world of men and women and retired to the desert in despair and heavy grumpiness. But the high chaparral laughed and said to the Arisian faithful, "Our brother torments himself with no cause, for even the malign Illuminati are unconscious pawns of the divine plane of Our Lady." Mordecai Malignatus K.N.S. The Book of Contradictions, Liber 555. October the 23rd, 1970, was the 35th anniversary of the murder of Arthur Flegenheimer, alias the Dutchman, alias Dutch Schultz. But this dreary lot has no intention of commemorating that occasion. They are the Knights of Christianity United in Faith. The group in Atlantis were called Mouths of Luhav Kiraft, United for the Truth, you see what I mean. And their president, James J. Smiling Jim Treponema, has noted a bearded and therefore suspicious young man among the delegates. Such types were not likely to be KCUF members and might even be dope fiends. Smiling Jim told the Andy Frayne ushers to keep a watchful eye on the young man so no funny business could occur, and then went to the podium to begin his talk on sex education, communist Trojan horse in our schools. In Atlantis, it was numbers, nothing Aryan squid trap in our schools. The same drivel eternally. The bearded young man, who happened to be Simon Moon, advisor to Teen Set magazine on Illuminati affairs and instructor in sexual yoga to numerous black young ladies, observed that he was being observed, which made him think of Heisenberg, and settled back in his chair to doodle pentagons on his notepad. Three rows ahead, a crew-cut middle-aged man who looked like a suburban Connecticut doctor also settled back comfortably, awaiting his opportunity. The funny business that he and Simon had in mind would be, he hoped, very funny indeed. We shall not be moved. There is a road going due east from Dayton, Ohio, toward New Lebanon and Brookville. And on a small farm off that road lives an excellent man named James V. Riley, who is a sergeant on the Dayton police force. Although he grieves the death of his wife 2 years back in 67 and worries about his son, who seems to be in some shady business involving frequent travel between New York City and Cuernavaca, the sergeant is basically a cheerful man. But on June the 25th, 1969, he was a bit out of sorts and generally not up to snuff, because of his arthritis and the seemingly endless series of pointless and peculiar questions being asked by the reporter from New York. It didn't make sense. Who would want to publish a book about John Dillinger at this late date? And why would such a book deal with Dillinger's dental history?
You're the same James Riley who was on the Mooresville, Indiana force when Dillinger was first arrested in 1924?
The reporter had begun.
Yes, and a smart-alecky young punk he was. I don't hold with some of these people who've written books about him and said the long sentence he got back then is what made him bitter and turned him bad. He got the long sentence because he was so snotty to the judge. Not a sign of repentance or remorse, just wisecracks and a know-it-all grin spread all over his face. A bad apple from the start, and always hell-bent for leather, in a hurry to get God knows where. Sometimes folks used to joke that there were two of him he'd go through town so fast, rushing to his own funeral. Young punks like that never get long enough sentences, if you want my opinion. Might slow him down a bit.
The reporter, what was his name again? James Mallison, hadn't he said, was impatient.
Yes, yes, I'm sure we need stricter laws and harsher penalties, but what I want to know was, where was Dillinger's missing tooth? On the right side or the left side of his face?
Saints in heaven, you expect me to remember that after all these years?
The reporter dabbed his forehead with a handkerchief. Very nervous, he seemed to be.
Look, Sergeant, some psychologists say we never forget anything, really. It's all stored somewhere inside our brain. Now, just try to picture John Dillinger as you remember him, with that know-it-all grin, as you called it. Can you get the picture in a focus? Which side is the missing tooth on?
Listen, I'm due to go on duty in a few minutes, and I can't be...
Madison's face changed, as if in desperation, which he was trying to conceal.
Well, let me ask you a different question. Are you a Mason?
A Mason? But Jesus, no. I've been a Catholic all my life, I'll have you know.
Well, did you know any Masons in Mooresville, I mean, to talk to?
Why would I be talking to the likes of them with the terrible things they're always saying about the church?
The reporter plunged on.
All the books on Dillinger say that the intended victim of that first robbery, the grocer B.F. Morgan, summoned help by giving the Masonic signal of distress. Do you know what that is?
It would have to be a Mason. I'm sure they wouldn't be telling. The way they keep their secrets by the saints, I'm sure even the FBI couldn't find out.
The reporter finally left, but Sergeant Riley, a methodical man, filed his name in memory. James Mallison. What did he say? Joseph Mallison. A strange book he claimed to be writing about Dillinger's teeth and the bloody atheistic Freemasons. There was more to this than met the eye, obviously.
Like a tree that's planted by the water, we shall not be moved.
Miskatonic University in Arkham, Massachusetts, is not a well-known campus by any means, and the few scholarly visitors who come there are an odd lot, drawn usually by the strange collection of occult books given to the Miskatonic Library by the late Dr. Henry Armitage. Miss Doris Horace, the librarian, had never seen quite such a strange visitor, though, as this professor, J.D. Mallison, who claimed to come from Dayton, Ohio, but spoke with an unmistakable New York accent. Considering his furtiveness, she found it no surprise that he spent the whole day, June the 26th, 1969, poring over the rare copy of Dr. John Dee's translation of the Necronomicon of Abdul al-Hats read. That was the book most of the queer ones went for. That, or The Book of Sacred Magic of Abra Melin the Mage. Doris didn't like the Necronomicon, although she considered herself an emancipated and free-thinking young woman. There was something sinister, or to be downright honest about it, perverted about that book, and not in a nice, exciting way, but in a sick and frightening way. All those strange illustrations, always with five-sided borders, just like the Pentagon in Washington. But with these people inside doing all these freaky sex acts with these other creatures who weren't people at all. It was, frankly, Doris's opinion that old Abdul al-Hatsred had been smoking some pretty bad grass when he dreamed up those things. Or maybe it was something stronger than grass, she remembered one sentence from the text. Only those who have eaten a certain alkaloid herb, whose name it were wise not to disclose to the unilluminated, may in the fleshy see a Shoggoth. I wonder what a Shoggoth is, Doris thought idly. Probably one of those disgusting creatures that the people in the illustrations are doing those horny things with. Ugh! She was glad when J.D. Mallison finally left and she could return the Necronomicon to its position on the closed shelves. She remembered the brief biography of crazy old Abdul Al-Hatsred that Dr. Armitage had written and also given to the library. Spent 7 years in the desert and claimed to have visited Irem, the city forbidden in the Koran, which Al-Hatsred asserted was of pre-human origin. Silly. Who was around to build cities before there were people? Those Shoggoths? An indifferent Moslem, he worshipped beings whom he called Yog-Sothoth and Cthulhu. And that insidious line, according to contemporary historians, Al-Hatsred's death was both tragic and bizarre, since it was asserted that he was eaten alive by an invisible monster in the middle of the marketplace. Dr. Armitage had been such a nice old man, Doris remembered, even if his talk about Kabbalistic numbers and Masonic symbols was a little peculiar at times. Why would he collect such icky books by creepy people? The Internal Revenue Service knows this much about Robert Putney Drake. During the last fiscal year, he earned $23,000,005 on stocks and bonds in various defence corporations, $17,523,000 from the three banks he controlled, and $5,807,400 from various real estate holdings. They did not know that he also banked in Switzerland over $100 million from prostitution, an equal amount from heroin and gambling, and $2,500,000 from pornography. On the other hand, they didn't know either about certain legitimate business expenses which he had not cared to claim, including more than $5 million in bribes to various legislators, judges, and police officials in all 50 states in order to maintain the laws which made men's vices so profitable to him, and $50,000 to Knights of Christianity United in Faith as a last-ditch effort to stave off total legalization of pornography and the collapse of that part of his empire.
"What the deuce do you make of this?"
Barney Muldoon asked. He was holding an amulet in his hand.
"Found it in the bedroom,"
he explained, holding it for Saul to examine the strange design.
"Part of it is Chinese,"
Saul said thoughtfully.
"The basic design, two interlocking commas, one pointing up and the other down. It means that opposites are equal." "What does that mean?"
Muldoon asked sarcastically.
"Opposites are opposite, not equal. You'd have to be a Chinaman to think otherwise."
Saul ignored the comment.
"But the Pentagon isn't in the Chinese design, and neither is the apple with the K in it."
Suddenly he grinned.
"Wait. I'll bet I know what it is. It's from Greek mythology. There was a banquet on Olympus, and Eris wasn't invited, because she was the goddess of discord and always made trouble. So, to get even, she made more trouble. She created a beautiful golden apple and wrote on it, Callisti. That means, for the prettiest one, in Greek. It's what the K stands for, obviously. Then she rolled it into the banquet hall, and naturally all the goddesses there immediately claimed it, each one saying that she was the prettiest one. Finally, old man Zeus himself, to settle the squabble, allowed Paris to decide which goddess was the prettiest and who should get the apple. He chose Aphrodite, and as a reward, she gave him an opportunity to kidnap Helen, which led to the Trojan War."
"Very interesting,"
Muldoon said.
"And does that tell us what Joseph Malik knew about the assassinations of the Kennedy and this Illuminati bunch and why his office was blown up or where he's disappeared to?"
"Well, no,"
Saul said.
But it's nice to find something in this case that I can recognize. I just wish I knew what the Pentagon means, too. Let's look at the rest of the memos,
Muldoon suggested. The next memo, however, stopped them cold. Illuminati Project Memo 9, 7/28, JM. The chart appeared in the East Village Other, June 11, 1969, with the label Current Structure of the Bavarian Illuminati Conspiracy and the Law of Fives. The chart hangs at the top of the page, the rest of which is empty space, as if the editors originally intended to publish an article explaining it, but decided, or were persuaded, to suppress all but the diagram itself. Pat.
This one has to be some damned hippie or yippie hoax,
Muldoon said after a long pause, but he sounded uncertain.
Part of it is,
Saul said thoughtfully, keeping certain thoughts to himself.
Typical hippie psychology, mixing truth and fantasy to blow the fuses of the establishment. The Elders of Zion section is just a parody of Nazi ideology. If there really was a Jewish conspiracy to run the world, my rabbi would have let me in on it by now. I contribute enough to the shul. My brother's a Jesuit,
Muldoon added, pointing at the Society of Jesus Square.
And he never invited me into any worldwide conspiracy. But this part is almost plausible,
Saul said, pointing to the sphere of aftermath.
Aga Khan is the head of the Ishmaelian sect of Islam, and that sect was founded by Hassani Saba, the old man of the mountains, who led the Hashishim into the 11th century. Adam Weishaupt is supposed to have originated the Bavarian Illuminati after studying Saba, according to the third memo, so this part fits together. And Hassani Saba is supposed to be the first one to introduce marijuana and hashish to the Western world from India. That ties in with Weishaupt's growing hemp and Washington's having a big hemp crop at Mount Vernon. Wait a minute. Look at how the whole design revolves around the Pentagon. Everything else sort of grows out of it. So, you think the Defense Department is the international hub of the Illuminati conspiracy? Let's just read the rest of the memos,
Muldoon suggested. The Indian agent at the Menominee Reservation in Wisconsin knows this. From the time Billy Frechette returned there until her death in 1968, she received mysterious monthly checks from Switzerland. He thinks he knows the explanation. Despite all stories to the contrary, Billy did help to betray Dillinger, and this is the payoff. He is convinced of this. He is also quite wrong.
Children, 7 and 8 years old.
Smiling Jim Trepamina is telling the KCUF audience.
Are talking about penises and vaginas, and using those very words. Now, is this an accident? Let me quote you Lenin's own words.
Simon yawns. Banana Nose Maldonado evidently had his own brand of sentimentality or superstition. And in 1936 he ordered his son, a priest, to say 100 masses for the salvation of the Dutchman's soul. Even years afterward he would defend the Dutchman in conversation.
He was okay, Dutch-wise, if you didn't cross him. If you did, forget it. You were finished. He was almost a Siciliano about that. Otherwise, he was a good businessman and the first one with a real CPA mind in the whole organization. If he hadn't gotten that crazy head idea about gunning down Tom Dewey, he'd still be a big man. I told him myself, "You killed Dewey," I said, "and the shit hits the fan everywhere. The boys won't take the risk. Lucky and the Butcher want to cowboy you right now." But he wouldn't listen. "Nobody fucks with me," he said. "I don't care if his name is Dewey, Louie, or Fooey. He dies." A real German Jew. You couldn't talk to him. I even told him Al Capone helped set up Dillinger for the feds just because of the heat those bank heists were bringing down. And you know what he said? He said, "You tell Al that Dillinger was a lone wolf. I have my own pack." Too bad. Too bad, too bad. I'll light another candle for him at church on Sunday.
Hand in hand together, we shall not be moved.
Rebecca Goodman closes her book wearily and stares into space, thinking about Babylon. Her eyes focus suddenly on the statue Saul had bought her for her last birthday. The Mermaid of Copenhagen. How many Danes, she wonders, know that this is one form of representation of the Babylonian sex goddess Ishtar? In Central Park, Perry the squirrel is beginning to hunt for the day's food. A French poodle, held on a leash by a mink-coated lady, barks at him, and he runs three times round a tree. George Dawn looks at the face of a corpse. It is his own face. In Wyoming, after one sex education class in high school, the teacher was raped by 17 boys. She said later she would never teach sex in school again. Making sure he is alone in the meditation room of the UN building, the man calling himself Frank Sullivan quickly moves the black plinth aside and descends the hidden stairs into the tunnel. He is thinking whimsically. Hardly anybody realizes that the shape of the room is the same as the truncated pyramid on the dollar bill. Or guesses what that means.
In Wilmette, Illinois, an 8-year-old boy came home from a sensitivity training class and tried to have intercourse with his 4-year-old sister.
Simon gave up on his pentagons and began doodling pyramids instead. Above, beyond Joe Malik's window, Saul Goodman gave up on the line of thought which had led him to surmise that the Illuminati were a front for the International Psychoanalytical Society, conspiring to drive everyone paranoid, and turned back to the desk and the memos. Barney Muldoon came in from the bedroom carrying a strange amulet and asked,
"What do you make of this?"
Saul looked at a design of an apple and a pentagon. And several years earlier, Simon Moon looked at the same medallion.
"They call it the sacred cow,"
Padre Pederastia said. They sat alone at a table pulled off to the corner. The friendly stranger was the same as ever, except that a new group, the American Medical Association, consisting naturally of 4 kids from Germany, had replaced H.P. Lovecraft in the back room. Nobody knew that the AMA was going to become the world's most popular rock group within a year, but Simon already thought they were super heavy. Padre Pederastia was, as on the night Simon met Miss Mao, very serious and hardly camping at all.
"Sacred cow?"
Simon asked.
"It's pronounced that way, but you spell it C-H-A-O. A cow is a single unit of chaos, they figure."
The padre smiled.
"Too much. They're nuttier than the SSS,
Simon objected.
"Never underestimate absurdity. It is one door to the imagination. Do I have to remind you of that?
"We have an alliance with them?"
Simon asked.
"The jams can't do it alone. Yes, we have an alliance, as long as it profits both parties. John, Mr. Sullivan himself, authorized this."
"Okay. What do they call themselves?"
"The LDD.
The padre permitted himself a smile.
"New members are told the initials stand for Legion of Dynamic Discord. Later on, quite often, the leader, a most fetching scoundrel and madman named Chalene, sometimes tells them it really stands for Little Deluded Dupes. That's the Pan's Asinorum, or an early Pan's Asinorum in Chalene's system. He judges them by how they react to that."
"Chalene's system?"
Simon asked warily.
"It leads to the same destination as ours, more or less, by a somewhat wilder and woollier path."
"Right hand or left hand path?"
"Right hand,"
the priest said.
"All absurdist systems are right hand. Well, almost all. They don't invoke you-know-who under any circumstances. They rely on Discordia. Do you remember your Roman myths?"
"Enough to know that Discordia is just the Latin equivalent of Eris. They're part of the Arisian Liberation Front, then."
Simon was beginning to wish he was stoned. These conspiratorial conversations always made more sense when he was slightly high. He wondered how people like the President of the United States or the Chairman of the Board of GM were able to plot such intricate games without being on a trip at the time. Or did they take enough tranquilizers to produce a similar effect?
No,
the priest said flatly.
Don't ever make that mistake. ELF is much more, esoteric outfit than the LDD. Chalene is on the activist side, like us. Some of his capers make Maritori or God's Lightning look like Trappists by comparison. No, ELF will never get on Mr. Chalene's trip.
He's got an absurdist yoga and an activist ethic,
Simon reflected.
The two don't mix.
Chalene is a walking contradiction. Look at his symbol again.
I've been looking at it, and that Pentagon worries me. Are you sure he's on our side?
The American Medical Association came to some kind of erotic or musical climax, and the priest's answer was drowned out.
What?
Simon asked after the applause died down.
I said.
Padre Pederastia whispered.
That we're never sure anybody is on our side. Uncertainty is the name of the game.